Iran Radio. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
International Media Festival.
Part 2.
Comedy. What is it? And does it even have a place in today's world that's been afflicted with the pains of death and destruction as a result of war? Can this genre of dramatic literature that deals with the serious in a satirical manner tickle the mind and wake us up from political slumber? This is Sob, and I'm your host, Hassan Tavakoli.
One of Ireland's finest comedians, Tadhg Hickey, has a one-of-a-kind way of educating people on politics and giving them a fresh perspective on how to view the world around them. I sat down with Tadhg to have a chat about his entertaining yet powerful political activity that focuses on both domestic Irish politics, especially Irish reunification, and international politics, in particular, the issue of Palestine.
Hi, Kiki. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here. Pleasure to see you again.
Well, you've done comedy about Palestine. Regarding Irish politics, you've also done some comedic acts. The hot topic discussed nowadays in Ireland, the whole of Ireland, is the issue of reunification, many say. And perhaps Ireland, the whole of Ireland, will reach that stage one day. We don't know. But first of all, the issue of reunification, how significant is this issue to you?
I would say before the genocide in Gaza, it was the main focus of my attention. As I say, I didn't come from a particularly political background, but from the time that I started reading in school, I felt that I had an understanding of the North that wasn't the traditional understanding in the South, that there were no monsters in the North, that there were reasons why the IRA felt compelled to initially defend their community and to try and liberate the six counties of the North. Again, in the current climate, I think we're getting a new, nuanced understanding of these labels like terrorist versus freedom fighter and where you kind of stand and all that. I suppose because I read a bit and I developed friendships with people in the North, I understood just what they went through pre-Troubles and post-Troubles. And I felt a kinship with them, and I wanted to buck the trend that you would get in the North of, as I was saying to you, this kind of disconnect on all sorts of levels. People in Cork and Dublin generally wouldn't, and it's even the same today, it's improving a little bit, but you could get people in the south of Ireland that have travelled to Dubai and Australia and America and they mightn't have been to Belfast. So that's the level of disconnect. And I don't blame the people. We had a lot of really strong, sophisticated propaganda to tell us in the south by the political elite and the media elite, don't go there, it's dangerous, it has nothing to do with us, we wish they would just stop it, it's embarrassing us. That was kind of the climate that I grew up in. So who
do you mostly blame for this disconnection?
I would blame the political elite in the south of Ireland. I mean, we have the Irish Times and the Irish Independent and RTE were run by people, and the nicest thing I could say about them was that they had a vested interest in continuing partition. You know, they had a nice little kind of fiefdom of their own in the south, and they didn't want the trouble of the north, and they didn't want to recognise their own abdication of responsibility for the north. So the south played a huge role in the disconnect and the troubles in the north because it was never there for its brethren. One of the beautiful things about Irish solidarity with Palestine at the moment is a friend of mine who'd be a Republican and he's a little bit older now said it's great to see the solidarity with Palestine because we never showed it to our own people. We never showed it to our own people when they needed it. And Sean will obviously be able to tell you a lot more about that. But I think, to go back to your question, I became interested very young, and then you understand the role of colonialism and you understand the bitterness and the violence and all that kind of stuff, and then you need to get to a point where you look ahead. And the republicanism that I'm interested in has always looked ahead and not to the past, and building a future for Ireland, as I say, that's going to take the best of what we've got in both jurisdictions, and it's going to build something new. And that building something new as well is going to not just be Catholics and Protestants. There's people of all faiths in Ireland now. They need to be represented and they need to be made feel that Ireland is a welcoming place. There's no point in the likes of me advocating for Palestinians or Arab people, you know, in their own countries. We need to make sure that the Arabs and foreigners, for want of a better word, feel very welcome and feel like Ireland is their home if they want it to be. And they have every equal opportunity to somebody who has been born in Ireland and reared in Ireland.
We'll be right back after this short break. Stay tuned.
Oh, bother. Not this again.
Yeah, this again.
For the umpteenth time, can you please give me back the things you stole from me?
Wow, no hi, how are you or anything?
Firstly, I didn't steal them, did I? I acquired them.
All right, how?
Oh, by burning your house down and taking them without your consent. Yeah, I know, but if you don't mind me saying, it's a little bit provocative to call that quote-unquote theft. Yeah, words matter, friend. And anyway, that was a long time ago. Back then, I just didn't realise that you were a human being with rights, values and feelings like me. And that's my bad. But I'm a different person now.
Well, Ireland was the very first imperial project, if you want to say, by the British Empire. Of 800 years ago, they invaded this island. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the remnants of that British colonialism would be the DUP party today in the north of Ireland. What do you see parallels between nationalists versus the DUP and Palestinians versus the Israelis? What parallels do you see?
I kind of feel like, and obviously I'm biased, I suppose, right? So I'll try and give as less a biased answer as possible. I feel like Irish Republicans and Irish nationalists, their relationship with Palestine is it's very long. You know, it's a rich tradition of understanding each other. Both freedom groups of freedom fighters have been on hunger strike, for instance. There's a Palestinian friend of mine told me recently that when Palestinians go on hunger strike, they call it an Irish strike or a Bobby Sands strike, or, you know, so there's a rich history and understanding between Irish republicanism and Irish nationalists and Palestine. It's not all, but it seems to me that some of the British unionist or British loyalist support for Israel, for instance, would be about which side are you guys supporting, or we'll take the other one, you know. So it's a provocative move that doesn't necessarily have, I think, the same level of history or the same level of empathy or understanding. You even have some loyalists at the moment supporting Israel. In this most, I would say, difficult moment to support Israel, they're still quite openly supporting a country that's effectively on trial for genocide. So there's something about Palestine, though, and you can see it in the Palestinian community in Ireland right now, because I'm at many events where Palestinians and Irish are together. They're performing together. They're sitting together. It really is the most extraordinary symbiotic relationship. And in fact, Daniel Mate, who is a psychotherapist, he's the son of Gabor Mate, he recently visited Ireland and I spent some time when we did a comedy sketch together. And unprompted, he said that as well. He said, I've never seen anything so bizarre in my life that, you know, an Irish person goes up, sings a little bit in Arabic, sings a bit in Irish, sings a bit in English, and then a Palestinian gets up, sings their bit. The songs seem to have a relationship with each other, you know, because it's the same struggle I believe it's the same struggle. And the one thing that I'm very proud about Ireland is that our solidarity with Palestine, it seems to transcend ethnicity, religion, because people sometimes think, oh, why would we support them? They're not like us. They don't look like us. They don't have the same skin colour. They're not Catholic, you know. But I think because of our colonial past, it's in our DNA. When we see people being dehumanised, that's us. We went through the same thing. When there's cartoons in the Washington Post dehumanising Palestinians, we remember Punch magazine, when the British used to depict us as simian and lawless and prone to violence. And when we particularly see a population being deliberately starved in an attempt to commit genocide or ethnic cleansing, something in us, I think, something in our DNA, something in the very marrow of our being recognises it and feels like if we don't stand up for Palestine, we're not standing up for ourselves. We're not standing up for our past. So I would say it's a rich, deep spiritual connection. And I would argue that the loyalist connection to Israel is, it's opportunistic. And I better say enough because I'm loaded with loyalist trolls, so I don't want to create another generation of them for myself.
What does your family say about the recent comedy you're doing now?
You know, they're very supportive. Sadly, my parents are passed away.
God bless them.
Yeah, and I feel like my mom actually would have some concerns because she was a bit of a worrier. And I mean, the reality is that whatever about the effects of my career, there are some pretty mean people who would probably like to see me certainly fail in my career, if not much worse. And that would be a cause of concern for my mother. My sister obviously worries a little bit as well. But my partner, my daughter, I have an older daughter and a younger daughter. My older daughter and my sister, my extended family, I think at the start they would have been concerned for me only on the level of perhaps my own mental health, because this is horrific. I mean, what Palestinians are going through, I genuinely wouldn't even be able to imagine. And even what allies are going through, because of the stuff that we're watching, and you feel at times like you're knocking your head against a wall. So only on that level were they concerned for me. But I think, again, because the mowing the lawn has gone on so long that I found by month two or three, a lot of my family members and friends were joining me at marches, were being extremely supportive of what I was doing. And they weren't even looking at me in many ways. They were off doing their own things as well. Many of my friends, you know, have stood up and they've been counted during this period. And sadly, without being negative, I have to say there's definitely been some friends of mine and there've been some colleagues of mine. I cannot believe that they've seen what they've seen and they haven't stood up and said anything and used maybe their platform or their resources to do something. And it speaks to just this kind of underbelly of racism in the West. I mean, there's no way addressing it up. There's a kind of a white supremacy and a racist thinking in the West that some people are very aware of and they embrace, and other people are not so aware of it. But by God, it's there, because there is no way that friends of mine, I feel, would witness white people being murdered in those numbers, starved to death in those numbers, and would sit silently at home doing their own thing that they were doing. No way.
Well, as a comedian with a courageous passion to, you know, question the hypocritical mainstream media, what challenges do you face that other people in your line of work do not?
I mean, first and foremost, the challenge is censorship. So that's what we're going through at the moment, all of us. Palestinians, by the way, you're probably well aware, are going through this on a much greater level. Because I'm white and I'm from the West, I'll get away with more. But I've still had my TikTok account cancelled. Subsequently, I was reinstated. I didn't do anything. I have no idea what's going on in TikTok, to be honest. I get sketches removed all the time. I've gotten banned. Then I get put back up. Instagram is one of the most insidious ones. They give you warnings and they restrict the viewers on your sketches. They put you down the list or whatever. The algorithm punishes you. Because sometimes I would share sketches, again, from Palestinians. So Palestinians would sometimes message me saying, can you share this because I've been banned? I have to set up a new account and I will share it. And I get slaps on the wrist for sharing content from the genocide. So the people committing the genocide seem to be acting with relative impunity, and the people reporting it are getting cancelled and restricted online. So I think it's really insidious on Instagram, and it's tough because my main source of activism is online. My main source is social media, and many people are in the same situation. Yet you have to deal with these companies where you have to toe the line to a certain extent. Having said that, I actually have not really towed the line that much. I still post what I want to post. A lot of the stuff that I do is satire. So if you're going to take down satire, which has happened, it has happened. If you're going to take down satire, you're basically, you know, trying to cancel an ancient form of responding to power. That's, I mean, satire is as old as time itself. So the censorship is the worst one, because I don't mind my sketches being lifted. I'm honoured when my sketches get lifted and get translated into Arabic and Farsi and other languages. That is an absolute honour. But I want my message to get out there, because, I mean, I'm kind of committing most of my time to it at the moment, so it would be very frustrating for the message not to get out there. And sometimes I'll post a sketch and it won't get any views anywhere near what it usually would, because I'm being so restricted, or you get, like, shadow banned and all these kind of things. I think when the dust settles, it's not the primary thing, but when the dust settles, these big tech companies should answer for the tech fascism and censorship that they have unleashed on Palestinians in their moment of need. I think it's morally repugnant what they've done. And the other things I'd face is that there's people online, you know, trying to garner support to get my gigs cancelled. I haven't had any corporate work in the last kind of 7 or 8 months. I used to get regular voiceover work. We spoke about the voiceover. I mean, good voiceover work is very important for my, or was certainly very important for my income, and it, like, dried up 2 weeks after October 7th. No auditions, no emails. And again, that speaks to the kind of way that Ireland is pro-Palestine in terms of the people, but the media class are very beholden to US interests. So, now I would say that I don't wish to be whiny, because I'm being supported both spiritually and emotionally, but also financially. I have a Patreon account. I have a PayPal. Most of my subscribers and patrons are from the Arab world, and I love that. Patreon is like a little love-in, if people don't know it. It's like a social media platform where no one's nasty. Everyone's kind of really interested in you and your life, and I do...
And they're supportive.
Supportive, and they really get what you're doing. I get messages there all the time from people saying, you know, I'm second generation Irish or second generation Palestinian, and to see your content, it made a difference. And I do an Ask Me Anything once a month, and I get well paid there, actually. I have more than enough to get by. It mightn't have been as much money as I was making beforehand, but, you know, I'm not trying to make myself out to be a hero, but it's not about money. Like, we're in the middle of a genocide, you know what I mean? So some things are more important.
Yeah. There's another sketch of you.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
So, guys, what we're talking about is if somebody's using unreasonable force against you, you have the right to fight back to protect yourself.
Yes.
So say he's been bullying me for years. I have the right to give him a few smacks then, do I?
No, that's terrorism.
Huh? If he does hit me back, though, I have the right to kick him to death then, don't I?
Yes, but be surgical with the kicks.
Are you for real?
Listen, pal, I don't make the rules.
Yeah, you do.
Oh, yeah.
He hit me the other week, so it's okay if I hit him back, yeah?
Weirdly, no. That would be an unprovoked attack.
Are you high?
Why?
Because I don't like you.
You know what?
This class is a load of...
Why me? Well, I'm so lovely and I never do anything to anyone. Let's kill him, Dad.
I've created a monster.
Speaks a lot. I've created a monster. I mean, speaks a lot about what's really, yeah, you know, happening today, yeah.
Thank you. If I do say so myself, I'm quite happy with that sketch because I feel it packs a lot in.
It does,
packs,
yeah.
The idea of the monster, the creating the monster, but also just the double standards is there for everyone to see.
In that sketch, yeah, you say...
Yeah.
You say, who makes the rules? Yeah, you said, I don't make the rules. And that's the question to who makes the rules.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I think America has shown unequivocally in the last few months that international law, rules-based order, that's a joke. That's definitely a joke. There's one rule for the West and Western allies, and then there's another rule for everyone else. The West are the goodies, Iran, Russia, China, because they don't play the game with America, are by definition then baddies. And I feel like, particularly young people, they're waking up to all that stuff now.
Speaking about young people, what would your piece of advice be to aspiring, you know, artists who want to follow your line of work and especially take the bold decision to, you know, do such courageous acts of comedy?
Thank you for saying it's courageous. You know, the way I feel about it, again, is to go back to being true to yourself. You know, I see people, I see friends of mine who they mightn't necessarily work in the arts, but they just work in jobs that they don't really feel like they're being true to themselves. And they always get unhappy. Now, you can still get unhappy by being true to yourself, but I find there's just something about doing exactly what you want to do, that there's a kind of a joy in it that I think is very rewarding. And I kind of feel with young people as well, it's, you know, do something that you enjoy for sure, but also do some reading. Do some reading, like get into the idea of, and I think they're doing it anyway. I don't need to tell them because, you know, I've got a daughter who's 20 and that generation, I think they're going to sort the world out, to be honest with you. If you look at the, talking about courage, the kids, which is obviously in a derogatory way of describing them, the young people in American universities right now, like the stuff that they have to lose, they could lose their careers literally by the advocacy that they're doing. And they're not taking the easy option. They're not thinking of money. They're not thinking of the careers. They're standing up for what's right. They obviously have done the reading. And that's a big thing for me. It's, if I hadn't have picked up a history book and certainly gone to the north, for instance, and spoke to people, better again, speak to people who've grown up in that area, like coming to Iran.
First-hand information.
I have... all I can gather about Iran is the kind of stuff that I've read personally, obviously, and whatnot, but I grew up with Western propaganda, and it's hard, like, Western propaganda is a hell of a drug. It's hard to get all that out of your system. You got to go and you got to meet the people and then you'll have new impressions. So my advice for people, for young people, would be do the reading, go and meet the people, make up your own mind. Don't swallow the propaganda. And if you're an artist and you get interested in politics and you get interested in portraying the way the world perhaps actually works, there's nothing as joyful or gives you a stronger feeling of worth, actually, as an artist, than to fuse your skill set, your artistic skill set, with your beliefs, both about politics and about humanity, I think, really, in the case of Gaza right now. It's not even a political issue, is it? It's a human being issue.
So how supportive would you be if your daughters wanted to, you know, follow you, follow, you know, do comedy and all that?
Looking for
have they ever, you know, started something up? Showed any interest, perhaps, yeah?
Yeah, I'd be definitely supportive. And I don't think I'd be one of those worrying... I don't worry, you know, I worry... I mean, I'm a crazy guy. I've got a background of mental illness and alcoholism. And I worry about stupid stuff. But I don't worry about being killed, or I don't worry, you know... Like, when I was coming over here, there's a massive ignorance about Iran in the West. And people who mean well would say, oh, be careful, that's a dangerous country. I've never been in a safer country in my life. I was in a gathering of, like, millions of people today, and I didn't get one cross word. Nobody pushed me. I wonder if I could say that about the West, even my own country. I don't think I would feel that safe. So, or sorry, if I was, you know, from another country or another ethnicity, I don't know would they feel so safe in Ireland. So, if my daughter, she's only one, my younger daughter, she's only one. I don't know what her ambitions are for the future, but if she wanted to advocate for oppressed people, and whether that was in comedy or human rights work or whatever, I would be especially proud of her, because that's the best thing I can think of doing with my time.
Okay, Tyke, at the end of the program, every program, we have this section where we request our guest to look into the camera and speak their mind about something that's really concerning to them.
The thing that's on my mind and is most concerning to me is, and for a long time now has been, Palestine. And my message is just to the wonderful activists all over the world, the students in the encampments, the Palestine solidarity groups all over the world, the tribe that we've built during this horrific genocide. Let's keep that tribe together so that we pursue Palestine and its needs, right to liberation, justice and statehood. And let's stay together as a tribe and build a mass movement for anti-imperialist causes all over the world. We have the power when we stand together. The people always do. Thank you.
Thanks, Tadhg. And we thank our guest, Tadhg Hickey from Ireland, for taking part in this programme. Until another programme, from me, Hassan Tavakoli, and the rest of the team, is goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
A new analysis has indicated that Donald Trump's plan to deport millions of immigrants from the United States would cost hundreds of billions of dollars. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. In the last month of the presidential campaign, President-elect Donald Trump doubled down on his promise to carry out the largest mass deportation effort in American history. In Reading, Pennsylvania, Donald Trump drew fervent applause from a rally crowd after saying he would get these people out and deport them so rapidly. In Aurora, Colorado, Trump told rallygoers he would rescue Aurora and every town that has been invaded and conquered. Immigration researchers, lawyers and economists have pointed to immense constitutional, humanitarian and economic problems posed by Donald Trump's oft-repeated pledge. But beyond the anticipated damage to immigrant families, communities and local economies, the roundup and deportation of some 11 million people is near impossible to bankroll. According to an analysis of U.S. budget and immigration court data by CBS News, such an effort would cost hundreds of billions of dollars. Even if Congress approved the hundreds of billions of dollars in spending, deporting every undocumented immigrant living in the United States would take far longer than 4 years, according to the analysis. CBS News analysis of immigration system data found that apprehending and deporting just 1 million people could cost as much as $20 billion for the U.S. taxpayer. Deporting 11 million people over 4 years would cost more than 20 times what the nation spent a year over the last 5 years on deporting people living in the United States. Most of that would be new funding that would have to be approved by a majority of both chambers of Congress. Assuming that Donald Trump did get the funding and could rapidly expand the staffing in immigration enforcement and courts, the backlog of cases would grow, not decrease, by millions of cases based on what's happened in the last two administrations. Trump's own administration, despite promising to deport millions of people in 2016, deported 325,660 people during the fiscal years that he was in office. Over the last five fiscal years, it cost an estimated $19,599 to deport one person, according to a CBS News analysis of federal data. That figure is based on budget allocations for each step of the deportation process. The apprehension of an undocumented immigrant living in the United States, detention of that immigrant, the immigration court process, and transport out of the country. From 2021 to 2023, as migrant crossings at the southern border reach record highs, Immigration and Customs Enforcement deployed roughly a sixth of its workforce typically dedicated to deportation to the border to assist Customs and Border Patrol. ICE, or Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also diverted resources to removals under Title 42, an emergency health authority enacted during the pandemic that allowed Border Patrol to turn away migrants attempting to cross the border into the United States. Fewer people were deported from the interior of the United States during those years than in prior years, which drove up the cost per deportation. But even when Donald Trump was president and the number of border crossings was lower than they were during the post-pandemic spike, the cost of deporting one person was still $14,614. To deport all 11 million undocumented immigrants estimated to be living in the United States would cost between $40 billion and $54 billion a year over the next presidential term. Even the lower end of that annual estimate, $40 billion, is enough to provide 20 million families each with a child tax credit each year, and is more than double the Federal Emergency Management Agency's entire budget. Over 4 years, the sum, amounting to $160 to $216 billion, is comparable to the cost of constructing around 500,000 new homes across the country. A similar analysis from the American Immigration Council put the total cost of deporting 11 million people even higher, at roughly $315 billion. Donald Trump has said the local law enforcement will help with mass deportation since they know their names, they know their serial numbers. But experts are saying it's not that simple. One of the assumptions in the Trump proposal is that those local police and sheriffs are going to cooperate. According to Abigail Andrews, director of the Center for Comparative Immigration Studies at the University of California at San Diego. Abigail Andrews says, "We know from the last couple of decades that one of the major ways for cities and states to dissent around immigration processes has been for the police to cooperate or not cooperate with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement." Trump has said he would deploy the National Guard to identify and detain immigrants who have entered illegally. That plan could face legal barriers since law prohibits the use of federal troops for civilian law enforcement unless authorized by Congress. CNBC has also covered the same story and tells us more. President-elect Donald Trump won the White House based partly on his promises to rein in immigration, with targeted policies that range from sending criminals to their home countries to more sweeping ones like mass deportations. During the campaign, Donald Trump pledged to end the temporary protected status that allows workers from select countries to come to the United States to work. If some of the larger deportation efforts like rolling back the temporary protected status come to fruition, experts say that there will be ripple effects felt in most sections of the economy, in particular in construction sector, housing and in agriculture sector. Economists and labour specialists are most worried about the economic impact of policies that would deport workers already in the United States, both documented and undocumented. Staffing agencies are particularly worried about Donald Trump's pledge to mass deport undocumented immigrants. Jason Leverant, president and chief operating officer of At Work Group, said, "The morning after the election, we sat down as a leadership team and explored what does this mean for talent availability. Workers, talent in industry parlance, are already in short supply. While the worst of the labour crisis spurred by the post-COVID economic boom has passed and labour supply and demand has come back into the balance in recent months, the number of workers available to fill jobs across the US economy remains a closely watched data point. Mass deportation would exacerbate this economic issue," according to employers and economists. Jason Leverant added, "If the proposed immigration policies come into reality, there could be a significant impact." There are various statistics offered up about the undocumented immigrant population in the United States. The left-leaning Center for American Progress puts the number at around 11.3 million, with 7 million of them working. The American Immigration Council and Advocacy Group also puts the figure at around 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States. The nonpartisan Pew Research Center puts the number closer to 8 million people.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing. Well, in this program, we answer your queries and questions and we discuss very important topics on Islamic upbringing of your children. Our answers are rooted in the Holy Book of Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today we have had the pleasure to be with Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum, sister.
A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you so much.
So, dear listeners, Brother Liaqat is really interested in conducting research in the fields of Islamic history, psychology, and philosophy. And currently, he's pursuing a master's degree in Islamic psychology at Jamiat al-Mustafa Institute of Islamic and Social Sciences. Well, Brother Liaqat, again, a very warm welcome.
Thank you so much, sister.
So we are glad to be with you again. And we have been discussing some very beautiful examples from the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. Especially you gave us also the examples of nurturing, how parents had nurtured their children and how they stood in Karbala for the imam of their time and how we can nurture our children again so that they can be there for the imam of their time. So yes, brother, today we would want to know more from you.
Thank you so much. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So on the day of Ashura, the day of lessons, it's not just an incident in the history. There are there are thousands and thousands of lessons where or what we can learn with regards to upbringing. There are many more what we can see, like with regards to political aspect, with regards to like other like economical aspect.
Hijab.
Seeing Ashura from an economical aspect as well. Of course, this is not my topic again. And with regards to upbringing, so Ashura has a lot of dimensions. If we go to see, and one of the dimension is upbringing. So going ahead, I was talking about the teenagers on the day of Ashura and their upbringing from the elders, how they brought up their teens. So one is Hazrat Ali Akbar alayhi salatu wasalam, whom we see, and also like we also see Abdullah ibn Imam Hassan alayhi salam, who was just about 11 and a half years old on the day of Ashura. And we see that he was the last shaheed before Imam Hussein al-Islam, even the shaheed after Al-Hazrat Ali al-Asghar al-Islam, according to the history, according to what we see. So we can see like he was a teen, yeah? So we see that a teen is the one like still supporting the Imam until his last breath.
Right.
So the Imam is in the ditch and the enemy wants to kill him like any moment. And at that time, a teen is the one, not an adult, a teen is the one who is coming still forward to support and protect his imam. So right. Abdullah ibn Imam Hussein al-Islam, who was eventually, of course, he got martyred in front of the eyes of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. Another example, Hazrat Ali Akbar alayhi salam, we see him as a beautiful example, who was Ashbahun Nas li Rasulih. So the one who was extremely, I would say, like very near to Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, with regards to his face, his expressions,
appearance,
his talking methodology,
right,
his thinking even, yeah? So it's not just, oh, you know what? He used to look like Rasulullah. No, it's not just, it's also his thinking and his speaking methodology. Everything was near to Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Of course, he's not an imam, but he's a teen. And we can see these qualities in Hazrat Ali al-Akbar alayhi salatu wasalam.
Right.
So, and also another example, what we see on the day of Ashura, again, with this dimension of tarbiyah, is if a person does tarbiyah properly towards his son or daughter, a teen, and there were other daughters like who are teenagers on
right.
the day of Ashura again, who sacrificed everything what they had after the day of Ashura, after the killing of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. So it's not just the son who went ahead into the battlefield. We saw the daughter of Imam Hussein alayhi salam delivering speeches, sermons
right.
On the way to Kufa and also in Kufa.
Right.
So yeah.
We'll discuss more with you, brother, after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing on IRIB English Radio. Brother Liaqat is with us. So, Brother Liaqat, you were saying that on the day of Ashura, the way the teens were nurtured, it showed up in that event and it remained a lesson for the generations. You said they were not only boys who were teens who fought in the battlefield, but the women, but the teens, the teenage girls who were there present in this event, they also showed, they also fought the wars with their words.
Exactly. I would say with regards to the teenagers who were girls, how they used to protect the hijab, if
right.
we see. Example, the daughters of Imam Hussein al-Islam. Of course, the adults are adults.
Right.
They have a lot of experience. Their knowledge is much more than the teens, isn't it? But even the teens who were there on the day of Ashura, they cried when their veils were snatched away. So this shows something like with regards to the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, when some Islamic wajib or something which is wajib upon a person is being snatched away from the person is crying aloud, crying out by saying, my right has been snatched away from me. Being a teenager again. And this was the upbringing of the parents, how they brought up their children, that this is being shown on the day of Ashura. Even we see this with a 3.5-year-old girl when her hijab was snatched away and she asked her aunt, like, oh, my dear aunt Zainab, salamu alayha, I want my veil back from the enemies. Then we see Sayyida Zainab replying to her by saying, Ammati Misluk, your aunt is also just like you. Even I don't have a veil.
Right.
So you see, like, so it's like this is shown even in a small child who is just 3.5-4 years old.
Right.
This is shown even in a teenager, and this is shown in adulthood as well. So the impact of upbringing, how we upbring our children, you see, like, again, it goes back to how we are speaking to them. How are we showing love towards them? Yeah. How are we valuing their words? And what teachings are we giving to them? Everything matters over here.
Right.
And, of course, like, where are they standing? With whom are they going? With whom are they coming back? Who are their friends? You see, everything matters.
Everything
of course, the,
has an impact.
Exactly. So... the
also,
parent, yeah.
The way you have brought up the issue of hijab over here, how these little girls and teenage girls and adults were concerned about their hijabs in the times of calamity, in the times of tragedy, because in this tragic situation, they could have just one excuse, like we were being looted from all the sides, so we had no way out, and like we had no other choice. But this being restless. This restlessness shows another modesty that they are veiled with, and the same is shown in the life of Lady Fatima Zahra Salam Alayha. That has personally helped me to observe more hijab. It's like when I heard the event of, like, she is being with Lady Feza on a window and they are watching a funeral is being taken, and then it's very obvious the funeral that the men were carrying was a funeral of a woman, and then Lady Fatima Zahra Salam Alayha says to Feza, "Oh Feza, when I die, first of all, I should be buried in the night time, and second, construct me a tabut. So construct me a tabut when I should not be. It should not be obvious, like, is there a male inside this or a female inside this?" So that's the, I would say, intensity
Indeed.
Of hijab or being worried about. And because after death, nobody is going to ask you. And when you are in a tragic situation, in a calamity, nobody is going, you're not accountable or you're not answerable. But yet we see this is the upbringing.
Indeed.
That has
this happens when the upbringing is embedded.
Right.
It's completely like dissolved in the soul.
Right.
Yep.
We'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere. Stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said, Allah will write a reward for he who kisses his child, and Allah will bring happiness on Judgment Day to he who makes his child happy.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat is with us, and we are discussing the impact that remains on the teenagers and the children of any age when they are brought up very carefully. Yes, brother. You were mm-hmm. giving us the examples.
So exactly. So I would say it's not a forceful impact upon a child. It's an impact which is embedded in a child or a teen, example. Of course, it starts from childhood and it shows more color when the child turns into a teenager, and it shows more colors when the child goes into his or her adulthood. So as the process of growth the physical growth goes ahead, even the showing of colors of the teachings and the upbringing of the person or the child shows more colors.
Right.
So these are the teachings from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and also from Amirul Mu'mineen. Of course, they would have beautiful discussions among themselves, isn't it? And in fact, when Sayyida Zahra salamul alayha, when she got married to Amirul Mu'mineen, she was just a teenager. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So over here we see four dimensions from the life of Sayyida Fatima, and one of the dimensions what we see from her life is the life of being a daughter towards her father. She
right.
is a teen, and how does a teen shows respect towards her father, isn't
right,
it?
Right.
Another dimension is a teen showing her love and affection towards her husband.
Right.
And a teen showing her love and affection towards the children. And a teen all by herself, Sayyidatin Nisa al-Alameen. She became Sayyidatin Nisa al-Alameen in her teenagehood, isn't
right.
it? When she was a
reaching
teenager.
This level.
Exactly. She was called, she is the Sayyidatin Nisa al-Alameen min al-Awwaleen wal-Akhireen. She's the leader of all the women of the whole existence from the start till the last. So she was just a teen, meaning a teenager can reach a value, a stage where he or she is called the leader of all the women. Or over here we see Sayyida Shabab Ahl Jannah, where he is called the leader or master of the youths of paradise, Imam Hassan alayhi salam and Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam. So this is what a teen has achieved during her teenagehood,
right.
isn't it? So
teens have this capability to reach spiritual heights. So dear teens, stop giving us excuses like I'm rebellious because I'm a teen, I am rude because I'm a teen, and I'm just going through these hormonal imbalances and all. All the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam, they were all brought to earth in the form of human beings, and they went through all those phases that we go through. And
indeed,
the difficult times that they have gone through, we have never seen that difficult time ever in the history. Thank you so much, Brother Liaquat, for being with us. That was
Thank
our today's
you.
Episode. Dear listeners, if you had any questions or queries, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. If you want to listen to our episodes again, go back to our official website. There's www.parstoday.ir/en. There's a tab, Call of Islam, and you can go there and you'll find an archive of our programs there. Thank you for listening. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's nuclear chief in a press conference with the IAEA's director general said the sanctions under false pretext are aimed at hampering the achievements of the Islamic Republic. The Israeli regime continues pounding Gaza indiscriminately as the regime's genocidal war death toll has risen to about 43,700. And Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement carries out fresh retaliatory operations targeting several Israeli military positions. Hello, everyone, and welcome to World News. And now, head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the country has faced harsh sanctions based on fabricated accusations aimed at hindering progress and achievements of the